Mr. Barnett, Rails 3. We were talking about your time when you were on a mine warfare course, and you were mentioning the S-bombs. What made them leap out of the ground? How had they designed it so that that happened?
Well, they had a propellant charge in the bottom. There were two canisters, one inside the other, and between the two were these ball bearings. And in the bottom of the outer canister was a propellant charge, like a cartridge, that was ignited by the fuse on the top.
How were you meant to deal with them? Because you were obviously learning how to deal with such things.
Well, the only way you could deal with them, you couldn't deal with them really in practice, because it used to be, Vicky was there, I used to be frightened of these things going out on night patrol, because there seemed to be no defence against them at all. And you couldn't possibly assume the threat there, or if you was even in daylight, never in the dark. So really there was no practical defence against them if you're, let's say, patrolling. If you had time in daylight, you could only tentatively walk forward with, say, looking out for the prongs and treading carefully, or feeling for the tripwire with a light cane or stick, hoping you wouldn't set it off before you actually found it. Once found, of course, you could deal with them by, obviously, by avoiding them or unscrewing the fuse. If you want, you could take them out, obviously. And the only recognised method of looking for mines in those days was prodding the ground with a bayonet or a spike. And if you felt resistance, then there was something there. But it was.
What are the kinds of mines or booby traps did they teach you about?
Well, there was it was the mechanical ingenuity of these things that's fascinated me. I've always been interested in mechanical things like that. And the other one was a rifle grenade the Germans had, which was a slim thing, about an inch diameter and 4 inches long, steel tube. And that could be fired from a cup on the end of a rifle barrel. And it had a clever coil spring in the nose, which the inertia of the discharge from the rifle barrel activated, so that when it struck anything on the ground, the button on the top had a spike inside which fired the cartridge, which exploded the charge, and its casing, which was a service-six steel casing, of course fragmented. Or that could be, you could remove the cap, take out the coil spring, screw the cap back on, which made it an instant press button device, which you could just put in the ground, and if that was stepped on, it would explode, probably just blowing up the man's foot. So that was an intrigue. Or you could, at the bottom end was another screwed knob which you could take out and attach to it with a short length of cord. So you could throw it as a hand grenade. That fired a 4 second fuse. So you could pull the button, throw it, and it was a hand grenade. So it had three uses. It was the mechanical cleverness of these things, the Germans made, which was. So first thing, and it once found a whole case of those left by the Germans, neatly packed, each in its cardboard tube in a metal attacher case, you know, about 50 of them. So I kept one for myself, of course, and took the charge out and still with it.
What, any other particular mines or booby traps?
Well, of course, they're anti-tank mines, the teller mines, they call them, which were the common ones the Germans used, which was heavy enough to blow the tracks off the tank if it rode over them. And that also had a fuse in the top which could be attached to, if necessary, necessary to a tripwire, so they could be used as anti-personnel or tank charges. They were very efficient. And I found one or two of those as well, which I defused and put the fuses into my turret.
That was, so that was the German mud. What about their booby traps? You mentioned the tripwires attached.
Yes, well,
what other sorts of booby?
Booby traps were really charges placed in such a way that, for example, if you opened a door, they would go off. Like the famous one that was, you could make up yourself, was to use an army oil bottle, which is a brass tube which fits into a rifle butt with oil in. If you're using an electric igniter and a battery, you could arrange them to say fasten it to a door knob. It was a tilt trigger, really. It was a ball bearing inside it, which you put inside it, would roll from one end to the other and make an electrical contact and blow up the charge, things like that. And tripwires, of course, inside buildings, when you pull a lever to chain, you know, that sort of device. So easily, easy to make. But really what they were teaching in the school is really what to look out for. And there are various tales told on how true they are.
Such as? What?
Such as, the well-known one was the chap. Of course, loot is always a bit attractive to soldiers, especially enemy weapons. And they're not very much to infantry soldiers because they haven't the room to carry them. It's the others that get caught. But there was the well-known one of the chap who, let me remember this correctly. Oh yes, he sees a Luger lying on the ground, you see. So he thinks, oh, that's a good souvenir. But knowing about booby traps, he thinks it might be booby traps, you see. So he ties a piece of string carefully to it without disturbing it, looks round and sees a slip trench to hide him while he pulls the Luger to see by this with the string to protect himself, jumps into the slip trench and jumps onto a mine, of course. The Luger isn't, is just a, that's the sort of story and care that you're supposed to take. But in actual practice, I never came upon any booby traps, nor did I ever know anybody who did. I've no doubt there were booby traps laid, but it's a very elaborate thing to set up. You've got to set it up when you're sure that you're leaving the place for good, or one of your friends or a civilian will walk into it. So there's not very many places really you can use them to good effect. I think they were probably more tales of horror than actual fact.
Now that's the sort of German side of you know, setting mines and booby traps. Mm. What about British mine warfare?
Well, we had mines, not that, to my knowledge, I ever saw, because we never laid them, because they, after I joined the army, we never retreated. So really, I've no doubt there were occasions when they were used, but not to my knowledge. And we weren't terribly well equipped with efficient mines. We had, as issued to us as infantry, a mine which we used to carry without very much pleasure. And that was the, I can't remember what they called it, but it was made out of a kind of polish. You know, what was the polish name? Johnson's wax polish used to be sold before the war in an oval tin. Like, it was liquid polish, like a flask. Flat, a bit like a big hip flask. And this tin was filled with explosive of a rather delicate kind, and on the back of the tin was welded a piece of metal which contained a detonator. And like a little bridge with a detonator underneath it and a crimp in the middle of the bridge. And then somebody stepped on it when it was late, thought it would break the detonator and explode the main charge. And they were, to my knowledge, never used. I never knew anybody who used one. We didn't like them because there were stories about those who were infantry soldiers who were carrying them in their packs, and when they tripped, they were, you know, they went off because they were rather delicate.
Who would carry them? I mean, would it?
Well, infantry men, it was a small mine given to infantry men to lay if they...
To everyone, or...?
Yes, you could bury it in the road, you see, you know, just under the surface of the road in a little hole.
So everyone carried one all the time?
No, because we didn't like them. They were issued and thrown away. And there's a funny story about that, because when I was with the KSLI, we were camped at Sousse, the battalion departed to the Pantelleria to embark, and it was the custom to put all the army rubbish into a pit. Each week a new big pit was dug, about 4 feet deep and perhaps 20 feet square, into which all the battalion's rubbish was thrown, and then every week it was sprinkled with petrol and set on fire to kill the flies and insects which bred in it, and eventually covered up. And when they departed for Pantelleria, they dutifully threw their little mines away, the rubbish pit, and it was sprinkled with petrol, blowing the rubbish all over the camp when it went off. So they were discarded, if possible.
So that was about all you learnt on the mine. You learnt mainly to dealing with the German mines.
Oh yes, and Italian. The Italians were producing some interesting ones in those days, which they do now, of metal-free mines. There were some made of wood and some made of clay. Like J&I, you know, so that they couldn't be found by detectives. But that was mainly what we learned about enemy weapons, you know.
So
and English explosives can deal with them, you know, charges of gun, use of gun cotton and ammo and the various high explosives.
What did you have, I mean, how did you learn how to handle the various, I mean, were there rules you had to obey?
Oh yes, in handling what, the mines or the
explosives? Well, both explosives. So.
Oh yes, of course. It was, the explosives particularly, of course, yes. There were rules.
Do you remember what they were?
Well, for example, gun cotton comes in tins, sealed tins, about the size of a big biscuit tin, with an ammunition box, of course, sealed with about perhaps a dozen slabs of gun cotton in. I think each one weighs a pound, I think. And they're about the size of a house brick. And they're wet. And if they're dry, they don't explode so well. And you can, in fact, gun cotton is a curious explosive. You can, for example, break it up and put a match to it, and it'll burn. The bits will burn, just burn, or explode. And I made a trick once in the mess when we were back in England, and I was dealing with explosives. I lit the fire in the mess with the gun cotton, using it as a fire lighter, which made people blanch a bit when I was just putting a match to it. And I told them what it was. But it's true, it will burn. And to ignite gun cotton, you have to put what you call, there's a round hole in the middle of it, into which you insert a bobbin of explosive, which is called a primer. It's like a cotton wheel, sorry. and into the middle of the cotton wheel, you put a little detonator. And you light the detonator with a piece of fuse. So it's a train of events, an explosion. And the nearer they are to the end of the train, that's the detonator, the more delicate it is, because I think it's fulminating mercury that's in the detonator. So they're quite delicate, and if you accidentally drop one, it might explode, but none ever did for me. I used to keep it in a cigarette case. So it's those sort of little rules, and then there's an even lower explosive, which is amino, which comes in 25-pound tins, and it's a black powder, which is used for, say, blowing craters. And there's a lovely arrangement, which I demonstrated once on Cyprus to the troops there, where to blow a crater, which of course is used to make a road inaccessible for vehicles, there was an explosive called, is this interesting, really? There's an explosive charge called a beehive. If you have an explosive charge behind a cone, an iron cone, the charge is directed in a straight line, in line with the cone. It's difficult to describe in words without drawing it. And the angle of the cone is critical. I think it's a 60-degree apex. So this thing is an iron container, and in the bottom side of it is conical, like the bottom of a champagne bottle a bit. And it has three little legs that it stands on at the bottom. That's why it's called a beehive, I think. And if you stand it on the ground, on rock, for example, which I did in Cyprus, and ignite it with a gun cotton primer and a bit of safety fuse, it drills a hole in the rock 2 inches in diameter and 6 feet deep, straight as a die down to the rock, instantly, as if it's been drilled with a pneumatic drill. Then, if you drop down the hole on the end of a piece of instant fuse or safety fuse, a charge of gun cotton primers which fit into the hole, you can blow at the bottom of the hole a cavity big enough so you've right got a yard of air with a hole down and a big bulb at the bottom. You could then fill the cavity with amino, that's the black powder explosive, and you can get a few pounds of it down there, and ignite that again with a long length of fuse. You blow a crater 6 feet deep and kind of 20 feet wide, depending on the ground. All very fascinating stuff, I think.
And you were taught that method while...
those were the things that they were dealing with at school, yeah. And different explosives work in different ways. Gun cotton takes the hardest line of resistance. That is to say, if you put it against a brick wall in a room and just prop it there with a stick, when it explodes, it won't explode back into the soft resistance of the air. It'll take the hardware and go through the wall. Unlike amino, which would be a bigger blast in the room, but wouldn't go through the wall.
Why is that?
I don't know why. But it does. And I used to do that too in training troops in later.
Any other explosives used in the army? By troops?
Well, fuses, of course, are interesting. There's safety fuse, which is the black slow burning fuse. Burns, if I remember rightly, at, I can't remember, it's 2 feet or 1 foot in half a minute. I think I used to have a swagger stick when I was in the army at one time, which is exactly a piece of cane 2 feet long, and I had it marked off in inches so I could measure fuse on it. I just put little dicks on it. And that's what you put into the detonator to to set up and it burns at a slow speed. There's then instant fuels, which obviously from what you said, it burns instantly. You light it at one end and it's at the other end at the same time, more or less. That's for igniting a charge, like at the bottom of the pit, without having to wait for it to burn all the way down in safety fuels. And then the third one is which we call Cortex, which is white in colour. Safety fuel is black. Instant fuel is red, and Cortex is white. That's actually an explosive string, as you might call it. That actually, if you wrap it round a telegraph pole, ignites it'll cut the pole. So fascinating stuff, and I had the opportunity to play with them later on.
Well, we'll yeah. Mm-hmm. So you were on the course in April 43, roughly, for a month or so.
Yes, it was a month.
And were the trainers our Royal Engineers?
Yes, and it was very good. I must say, that was during the whole time in the Army. The Army method of teaching, I thought, was absolutely superb.
What was it? Could you just, what was the essence of
it? Well, the essence of it is the old essence of teaching drill.
Shooting.
The use of weapons, generally speaking, and that was it. But God, it's actually called it. It's a demonstration, repetition. Yes, the basic use of, really, of all training, the basic method, was demonstration, which means the instructor demonstrates how to use a rifle, say. Then, imitation, which means that the men that he's teaching with their rifles imitate what he does, step by step. And then repetition means that they repeat that lesson themselves with their own nose. For example, a simple case of using a rifle, pull the bolt back, put in a clip of cartridges, push the cartridges down into the magazine, push the bolt forward, which ejects the cartridge clip, and then cock it up. That sort of thing. And
the same methods were used in the mine.
The same methods are used throughout, if they're applicable, in every case, of course. But I think the teachers in the Army are trained in a specific method of teaching. And of course, they have a very obedient class. But not only do they teach in a method which makes men able to remember, it's teaching in a lot of cases men who are of a mixed ability, obviously, so it's based on perhaps the most ignorant. It has to be clear, but it's made interesting. In other words, the length of lessons is carefully calculated so you're never bored. There's always a mixture of practical lessons and theoretical lessons, which means you don't get bored. It's carefully arranged so you don't have a sleepy lecture after lunch. And those sort of thoughtful processes are carried to the extreme. And I think a superb method of teaching. I've never had such good instruction as I've had during the Army.
And this course was well up to those standards.
Yes.
So what happened when you left the course after the month's course?
Well, I went back then. I must have gone back to battalion. I'm a bit, my memory's a little bit confused here. It was only, I think I went back because I do know that when I went back, to my delight, I found that Dick Putter and Ronnie Sherwood had joined the 16th Battalion. They followed me from the 14th and caught up with the battalion. And I remember the battalion was then at a place called Bleeder, about 40 miles inland from Algiers, at the foot of the Atlas Mountains on a plain, in under canvas. For the summer training before before the invasion of Italy, and I was delighted to see Giff and Ronnie, of course, and we set up our tent and for our three, the three of us, and were to very happy with the summer. But shortly after that, I was posted to the 1st Battalion of the Kaiserlei, again as a reserve platoon commander without a platoon. Two of us went. I'm not absolutely sure who the other chap was now from memory.
Now, as a newly trained mine warfare expert, what would you now have mine warfare equipment with you wherever you went?
No equipment, just knowledge.
So you didn't carry fuses or anything with you at that time, or explosives?
I wasn't operating in any way as the chap in the battalion who would do that was the officer in charge of the, what do they call it, platoon that did engineering in the battalion. Pioneer platoon, he would be the chap, and I wasn't the fly. I never had the pioneer platoon in those days.
Right, so you've been posted to the 1st Battalion Shropshire Light Infantry.
That's right, yeah.
And what happened when you joined them? And what?
Well, just incidentally, they were quite a long way off in Tunisia, of course. We were in Algeria. So it meant a long trip. And I made quite a few journeys along the North African coast from one time to another, sometimes by sea and sometimes by rail and sometimes by road. And I thought that was great because you were seeing I must say I enjoyed the peacetime bits of the army very much. I wasn't bored as many people were at all. I enjoyed the experience of the Mediterranean and the bathing, of course, was marvelous during that summer. So the trips too were interesting. We had, and I can't really remember now which particular ones I did by which particular kind of transport. But I went to the Kaiserlei, as I said, who were in Sousse. It was quite a long way, a few days it took to get there.
Now they were regulars, for the first.
That was a regular battalion, yes, in the 1st Division.
How did you fit in there? You'd had problems before with people with regular attitudes. Now,
yes,
now this was
for some reason this was a good lot. I enjoyed. They were very, very formal. Well, as formal as they could be in an olive girl, because they weren't in the barracks, of course. And the mess was the company. We used to mess by companies, and the company mess was forming a table on four legs in the olive girl, of course. And we had little tents. We didn't even have a big tent, we had little tents each. Each one with a slit trench dug inside. It's a shallow trench because we used to get bombed at night sometimes. But that was quite pleasant.
Which company were you in?
I wasn't in a company.
Not attached.
I was obviously attached to a company for messing. I don't know, I think it might have been a company.
What the bombing would be your first experience under fire, wouldn't it?
I suppose it was really, but it wasn't serious. We used to, the main danger was falling shrapnel from the ACAC guns, of course, and we used to, in the evening, as the light failed, we'd perhaps be finishing our dinner around our table, our door, and we'd have to finish the coffee sitting underneath the table instead of. That is, as you might say, that's all the bother we used to take, because the shrapnel used to rain down. We sometimes lay under the lorries or something to shelter ourselves from the shrapnel. But we were on near the beach too, so that we had good bathing there. And of course the Mediterranean wasn't polluted in those days, it was beautiful. And the mess bill there, I remember, used to be anything you spare, like an old cotton vest or a bag of dried TVs, because the only things that the catering officer could buy was by barter with the Arabs. So they used to get eggs, perhaps, and a bit of fruit from the Arabs by bartering old clothes. And they used to, the battalion had a bugle band, and they used to formally mount the guard every evening. We didn't take part in that because the two of us, because we weren't accustomed to their drill, and even light infantry battalions have different traditions of drill, of course.
Did you still regard yourself as a DLI officer?
Yes. It was only attached to as a reinforcement in case of casualties. Once again, there were always a couple of civilians spare. And they went to Pantomarine eventually. And of course, the Germans had left. The only, I didn't go, because there was no battle. There was an airfield there. With an Italian caretaker that was the only fellow on the island, I think. And the only thing that happened was they caught a lot of fleas sleeping in the building while the Italians had been. And the whole battalion came back and marched fully clothed and equipped into the sea, off the beach of Sousse, and undressed in the sea to get rid of them. And the fleas. And they were very pleased with the captures, and always had a typewriter for the company accounts clerk. So that was then over, and I was sent, went back to the time the two of us did, and the CO sent a 1500 weight truck for us from Leda to bring us back. So we had a lovely ride, taking several days to get back to Bleeder, you know, just the two of us and a couple of men in the truck. We used to stop at supply depot to draw our lessons, you see. And of course, the NCO in charge of the depot would look at the menu that all the army was eating on that day, you see, and issued you with it. So if it was marmalade at breakfast time, you got a £7 tin of marmalade for four men, because there's nothing smaller. And we used to buy. One of the dishes we used to love in those days was to get some spam, real spam. You could occasionally get issues and buy some eggs from the Arab and have fried ham and eggs. That used to be a favourite we liked to have. And then, of course, there was a method of cooking which was curious. In the desert, we used to, we had a big round tin, like a fruit tin, you see, which you half filled with sand, poured petrol into, soaked it in petrol and lit it and cooked your. Or brewed your tea over the petrol flame. There isn't really much rationing of petrol.
So you rejoined the 16th Battalion?
I rejoined the 16th at Leda.
Now, you became a lieutenant at that time as well, I suppose, a second lieutenant.
I did, yes.
Were you still reserve officer, or were you given a...
Oh, no, I had this for the first time in my life. I had a platoon, a real platoon. I was in charge of 13 platoon in C Company. And Ronnie was another of the platoon commanders. Tom Logan, I think, was the third platoon commander. George Joby was the company commander, a lifelong friend, best man at my wedding. And we were very happy.
What do you remember? I mean, this is your first platoon. What do you remember about the calibre of the men and how you got on with them? It was your first time in command.
Well, I tried to do the right thing. You know, I wrote all the names in the book and and talked to them all individually and wrote down notes about what they were in peacetime and so on. And they were not all condemned by any means. Some were from South Wales and Yorkshire, of course. They were mostly, a lot of them were miners or in similar jobs in peacetime, because they were some of them were hardly into jobs because, you know, they were all of a very young age, of course. And I have little memory of any outstanding characters. They were all good chaps. I'll just describe one incident, which is out of context, out of time perhaps, to describe to you the sort of people they were. I had a sergeant who was a Yorkshire lad, and he had a big black moustache, but that was to make him look older than he actually was. And we were attacking a party of Germans that we'd surprised one morning, and I was shouting at them to shoot, shoot. Wasn't any time to go fire, was they were all standing there anyway. There was no need to tell them what the target was. And this chap, I'll never forget him, he more or less danced round. You know, he was so excited, he was jumping from 1 foot to the other, and he was shouting, "Try to take prisoners, try to take prisoners." And that always astounded me, that this chap in that moment of crisis was concerned about not killing. Now that's the sort of people they were, and we did, we took some prisoners. We didn't kill anybody. And that really affected me, that these chaps could be so human at such a critical time.
Do you remember your sergeant?
That
sergeant, do you remember his name?
No.
But he was your regular sergeant.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, not regular, but, your usual sergeant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what was the, you were only training for a while and doing not next to, not, you know, for a while that summer, you know, waiting for the next thing to happen,
yeah,
I suppose.
Sometimes.
What, how did you get on, you know, between you, the men, and the sergeant? What was the sort of role of the sergeant? Was he between you and the men, or what was the relative roles, do you think?
Well, we were mates, really. There was no social distinction, except in the uniform they called you sir, which you can see all strange in those days. And we were all in the same boat. There was no distinction there.
What did you call him, your sergeant? Would you call him by?
Oh, I'd call him sergeant.
You wouldn't use his first name?
I'd use his name.
His surname?
No, never. Well, nobody. You see, not even at school were we using Christian names. It was never used. Of course, Ronnie and Vith were. All the officers in the mess were Christian names. But not the man.